Angie has made it easier than ever to connect with skilled professionals to get all your jobs projects done well. If you own a home, you know how much work it can take, whether it's everyday maintenance and repairs or making dream projects a reality. It can be hard just to know where to start, but now all you need to do is Angie that and find a skilled local pro who will deliver the quality and expertise you need. Angie has over 20 years of home service experience, and they've combined it with new tools to simplify the whole process. Bring them your project online or with the Angie app, answer a few questions, and Angie can handle the rest from start to finish or help you compare quotes from multiple pros and connect instantly, which means you can take care of just about any home project in just a few taps. Because when it comes to getting the most out of your home, you can do this when you Angie that. Download the free Angie mobile app today or visit Angie.com. That's Angie.com.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
The following program is a production of Chilling Entertainment and the creative team at Chilling Tales for Dark Nights, and a proud member of the Simply Scary Podcasts Network. Visit simplyscarypodcast.com to learn more about this and our other weekly storytelling programs, and become a patron today to show your support and get instant access to our extensive archive of downloadable ad-free tales of terror. Thank you for listening. And enjoy the show.
Good evening. I'm storyteller Otis Gyre, and I ain't your grandfather. From where I'm from, we don't do bedtime stories. And if that's what you were expecting, you're in the wrong place. If it's terrifying tales you're after, well then, I've got just the thing. Get comfortable, settle in, turn off the lights, if you dare. Your night is about to get a whole lot darker. Who needs sleep anyway?
Good evening. You're listening to Scary Stories Told in the Dark. Welcome to Season 8, Episode 19. I'm your host, Otis Gyre, and in this episode, I'll be performing four tales to terrify you, courtesy of author Grant Hinton, about deadly documents, alien arthropods, hellish hackneys, and paranormal playlists. You're listening to the standard edition of tonight's program, which contains the first two spine-tingling stories. If you'd like to show your support and enjoy an extended version of this and other episodes with twice the terror, visit simplyscarypodcast.com and click Patrons in the upper menu to sign up today. Thank you for your support. Now, it's time to take a walk together down the moonlit trail. So, lock your doors, turn your lights down low, and settle in. The show's about to begin. Twenty-eight isn't a very long time to live, but Sylvan Deiva finds himself approaching an age that seems to be cursed in his family. In our first Grant Hinton tale of the evening, a trip outside of the only home he has ever known leads Sylvan to a discovery about why his family is cursed. And perhaps the way out of it. Without further ado, I present to you Death's Inkwell. To understand the value of an hour, one must first cherish its passing, and what more profound a way than the slow, inevitable tick of minutes to measure the descent of your demise? To understand why I cherish this hour above all else, I must first take you back to a time when the frailty of my lineage was no more than a figment of chance marked on death's chalkboard. I, Sylvan, am the last of a tragic line of accursed men whose span has, parenthetically, lasted until now. My parents, I never knew. My mother died during childbirth. A disease of that birth stole her from my life. My father, similarly stolen, died later that very year at the age of 28 by a drunkard with a gun. He was never caught, and as such, my father's demise never saw justice. My care and education were left to a relic of a man I came to know only as Hakaz. Hakaz's birthplace was unknown to me, but I judged it to be possibly Middle Eastern by his ebony skin and dark eyes. With his strong but supple hands and his will as hard as the cane that bore his weight, he took me to a distant land. There I resided, learning by those leathery hands the ancient language of the alchemists, for Hakaz himself, a highly learned man, sought power over death. Hakaz's estate sat within the depths of a valley where light refrained from venturing. A rank, primordial forest whose evil vines and creeping plants crawled amidst the damp stone walls of my dwelling. Manned by many a whispering servant was I tended. I do not remember my wet nurse or of anything of my early years. Those were told to me and have formed a somewhat fragment dreamlike reality. Hakaz's tutelage started the moment I could talk, and I spent my childhood in darkened rooms for hours, absorbing tombs and scripts. The ancient papyrus of Egypt, scrolls of Arabic scholars and tomes of English gentlemen, preserved from time and light by thin sheets of virgin paper, lent to my obsession with the occult, an infatuation of my mentors that bled over to my young, susceptible mind. I procured a thirst for the arcane and occult so insatiable that it was many years into my teens until I became aware of the females that inhabited my stone prison. Then it was by the tongue and bosom of an equally aged girl called Frida that I learned of my family's curse. My lineage was never spoken of to me before or within the whispers of the other servants, although I saw it in their eyes, and when I pushed my mentor too far to hear of my ancestors, pain forced me to stand and lay awkwardly for a few days. I let the questions fade from my mind and allowed the symbols and science of his teaching to fill my adolescent brain. I know now that his real object was to keep my ears from learning the dread curse upon my family name, but I had already learned it and so sought to correct the impending doom. Upon my 21st birthday, Hakaz handed me my legacy, a tarnished and stained parchment of the most startling nature, and its perusal confirmed the gravest of my apprehensions. My bloodline and those that had all died before the age of 28 were within this despicable document, line after line of blackened ink, carrying the weight of the curse. I realized something stalked my ancient bloodline, eradicating each of the males. I delved more into the arcane than ever before. Science could not answer my questions, and so I thought the occult could. Time's irrevocable hand swept the sun and moon on their heavenly journey, bringing my fate closer. One night when my studies with Hakaz had finished, For in truth, his pursuit for something he said was nearing his reach, never ceased. I took to walking the streets outside his estate. The cobbles below my feet dragged by in the fallen gloom of the moon's light until I found myself outside a dilapidated shop. Beyond the dark gloom of the morbid interior, a single candle burnt on a desk, enticing me inside. A smell of dampness and parchment greeted me like an old friend, one who never left but just stepped outside. A man, withered like the leather-bound books in abundance around him, glanced at my approach. Without a word, knowing something beyond the realm of mortal men, he stood on crooked legs and searched the tomes in a carved-out hole within the stone walls to his right. I, without a glance backward, came toward the desk, where his ink stained a new leather book the color of crimson fire. I didn't know the language, despite my studies, but I did know the symbols of an alchemist. The man returned with a single volume cradled in the crook of his armpit. "This is what you seek." Without further word, he turned back to his task. I faltered only briefly, for want of asking questions. But knowing that he would not speak again, I exited back to the dark streets. In my chambers, I perused the text. The writer's crimson ink suggested that of a withered old man's hand, but the dates surpassed one of his age back a few hundred years. At this time, my studies had deep-seated me in my belief in the supernatural. Else, I would have shunned with malice the incredible narrative unfolding before my eyes. The pages carried me back to the days of the Persian Empire and an ancient man named Zahak, whose repute was terrible with the secrets of black magic and alchemy. He'd studied beyond the custom of our kind, seeking the supernatural remedies to life's aviation, such as the Philosopher's Stone, or the Elixir of Eternal Life, or even grosser still, Death's Own Cloak. One, legend said, was to exist and give dominion over the entity. Zahak, by the surname of Daiva, studied from ancient texts and learned of a secret passage to the dread abode of a race of monsters who were interred under a lost city, one sunken by the treachery of man and time. At the mouth of a black cave, weathered and fractured by generations of water and sand, he, Zahak, entered, neither turning back nor pondering, such was his desire. Under the cloak of his alchemy, the monster's slumber he did not disturb for fear of retribution, the ancient man traversed the cave. Excavated in the back of the rock, a structure nearly invisible and radiating maleficent intent appeared before him. The door, a ponderous and forbidding slab of onyx, hung upon rusted iron hinges. The winged beasts and horrors that had plagued mankind from the beginning of time awoke and regarded Zahak with equal measures of hatred and surprise at his tenacity to stand before their master's sanctum. Zahak, seeing his horde of beasts awaken, ran to the dread portal and squeezed his body through a crack at the foot of the giant door to escape the wrath of the vengeful demons. His senses, intoxicated with the suffocating and cloying scent of moss, damp rivers of cascading milky walls, and the subtly indefinable odors of the soil and rotten vegetation, pushed him onwards between the fissure of sharp rocks. A single candle, dancing a serpent's dance to the scratch of quill and parchment, haloed between the jagged shards, lit a cave. A lone specter of such vast magnitude, it seemed shadows and mist, it sat hunched over a slab of ancient marble. Zahak crept upon the fathomless being, his belief intact with every pristine fiber of absolution of the supernatural and demonic mysteries revealed. Death, for that was whom it was, disappeared, leaving behind his unfinished scroll. Zahak, upon seeing a chance to not only defy death but become a master of him, stole through death's eternal abode. On the cusps of death's table, he stood dumbfounded, for he had stumbled on death's ledger, a timeless enormity of names ready to be harvested at one's demise. Using tools of his alchemy, Zahak removed his name from the parchment. Not satisfied that death wouldn't find him, he procured glass vials and stole ink, as void as midnight, from the well of the slab. This, he surmised, would keep him alive well beyond his years, for not only would death not know who Zahak was, but the ink, being of supernatural quality and longevity, would also extend his years. Amused that Zahak had disappeared from death's chambers righteously, for the next story told of him again in another outlandish epic that I will save for another time. Instead, I flicked through the pages, musing that maybe it was more of an order than a singular obsession to record the lineages and deeds of men. I froze upon glancing at the back page, where hitherto were names, some such that their duplicity echoed within my own legacy. Upon the bottom lines were two names, one I knew as my father's, and below it still, further shocking me into a stupor, was my own, Sylvan de Ava, that I dropped at home. My fate, inevitably entwined with that of my curse, seemed to have been already recorded. I raced back to the dilapidated shop to find it gone, not a mere chance of a misplaced foot, but simply and plainly vanished. Vexed that I was a scapegoat to a man which had dominion over the greatest of the gods, for he is terrible and just, I delved deeper than ever before into the ancient tomes of Hakaz's disposal. I surmised that if Zahak could find death's door, one could find it again. As I drew nearer the age of 28, with only one waxing moon between us, Hakaz, as happy as I've ever seen him, came to me to explain a most peculiar predicament. It seemed that Frida had, in stomach, feet, and heart, swollen beyond the point of deception, and could no longer work at her station, and that I was the cause. It was with the illest repute, for I planned to end my accursed line with myself, that I sired a doomed offspring. Hakaz, however, after some time, did unburden me with this taxing information, for my mind was wrought with my impending doom by offering to keep mother and child in house. Something about the exchange of his words caught me as repugnant, and I delved back in time to my stay at his estate. Was my daughter to be bound in the shackles of his servitude, or might Hakaz raise up Frida from her lowly station? Curiously, I spent nights pondering this, slowly forgetting about the curse, until the night when I knew my assassin would breach the stone walls and collect my ancestral debt. I woke from our bed and laid bare feet on the floor. Frida, in the throes of a dream, murmured maternal things as I stepped across the floor to my writing desk. I lit a candle with flint and steel. A breeze from the shut window did make the flame dance as I opened the book and gazed upon a strike obliterating my name. Below, in faint red fire, were the forms of indistinguishable words. A cold hand of the hottest fire clasped my shoulder and dread coursed up my spine, for I heard not a door open.
If you so know the one who hides from me, your existence can continue.
The figure, shrouded in mist, spoke in a rumbling voice that chilled me through its hollowness. I shook my head, for I was duped by my wicked ancestor, as much as death himself, to knowing the identity of this thief.
Hakaz!
I turned to see Frida, awake and staring into the abyss of death's eyes, lapsed into a stupor, such was her fright.
Speak!
Frida, compelled by his voice, clutched the bedsheet so violently that her hand stood white in the dim light. She explained that Hakaz had been the lord of his estate for many years, more than was natural for any man or woman, even with the ancient knowledge of the alchemists.
"'Tis not right, sir," she groveled.
"Say his name. To know his name is so he cannot hide."
Death boomed. My heart did swell for her abandonment of fear that she stood up to death to save the soul of her husband. For that would be what I shall if the doomed curse was not on my head.
"Hakaz Videha,"
she shrieked.
"No,"
I whispered, as sudden realization dampened the edges of my fears with cold reason.
"Zahak Deva is the one you seek, but that name did die centuries ago. Hakaz Videha is one and the same, and that of who you seek."
Death swirled like mist and disappeared. I sat panting as Frida came to my side. We heard the screams of one who could no longer hide through the stone walls of Hakaz's ancient home. Such was his scream that I clamped my eyes and ears shut and did not open them again until it had stopped. When I did, with wonder so vast that would dwarf death himself, I witnessed the strike upon my name removed. In the glowing light of the fortuitous sun, I ventured to Hakaz's chambers. Stacks of tomes, scroll, and parchment that I had never known to exist plundered his room in dismal light. Curious oddities in glass jars and vials, that of which I had never seen in any botanical or anatomical drawing, or any such place, accompanied them on rows of high shelves. Above a stack of discarded clothing, which I hearkened to be Hakaz's, as I expected such was his howls, that I still heard them ghosting in my ears, I saw the most peculiar of them all. Amidst the spine of an ancient Sumerian document, and one of equal repute of Egyptian lore, sat a vial of the blackest night. Its contents, only just below that of its lip, I reached to inspect. Was this the fabled elixir stolen from Death's inkwell?
"Yes,"
the hollow voice rumbled through me again like one whose acquaintance had already been met. I stole around to see the mist swell and form into a void that sucked at my eyes and devoured all light. "A reward for the one who I have searched eons for. I will come for you when it is depleted." With that, Death vanished. Today, this hour, is my 201st birthday. My lineage is long and without curse, and I greet each hour with the same fragility that I once saw it as. Of the elixir, I have some still, to see my affairs in order. But this tale is to remind you of your own frailty, because each hour is a gift from one who can take it away as easily as you can squander it.
Angie has made it easier than ever to connect with skilled professionals to get all your jobs projects done well. If you own a home, you know how much work it can take, whether it's everyday maintenance and repairs or making dream projects a reality. It can be hard just to know where to start, but now all you need to do is Angie that and find a skilled local pro who will deliver the quality and expertise you need. Angie has over 20 years of home service experience, and they've combined it with new tools to simplify the whole process. Bring them your project online or with the Angie app, answer a few questions, and Angie can handle the rest from start to finish or help you compare quotes from multiple pros and connect instantly, which means you can take care of just about any home project in just a few taps. Because when it comes to getting the most out of your home, you can do this when you Angie that. Download the free Angie mobile app today or visit Angie.com. That's Angie.com.
I hope you enjoyed Death's Inkwell, as written by author Grant Hinton and performed by yours truly. If you enjoyed that first tale and would love to read more from tonight's very talented featured author, you can help support them by visiting simplyscarypodcast.com/Hinton. That's simplyscarypodcast.com/Hinton, spelled H-I-N-T-O-N. You'll be redirected to his profile on our horror fiction website, creepypastastories.com, where you'll find more info about Grant, as well as links to his official website, social media, and his collection of work available for purchase on Amazon. You'll also find a contact page where you can send him a message. If you do decide to stop by his profile, please consider leaving him a kind word and letting him know you heard about him on this show and that Otis sent you. It would mean a lot to me. And if you check out his Amazon listings, might I recommend his 2019 collection of 32 terrifying tales entitled Unread? Do you like stories about haunted houses? What about digital nightmares, creepy exorcisms, psychopaths, human experimentation, aliens, warped dimensions, mind-altering drugs, and terrifying paranormal encounters? Is that enough horror for you to handle? Because there's more where that came from. With over 24 tales of frightening fiction, you won't be getting any sleep once you've cracked open this tome. But hey, that's what we all want, right? Thanks again for your support of this program and of tonight's featured author. But don't go away, we're just getting started. I've got another spooky story coming right up. Death comes for everyone in the end, and if you've overstayed your welcome in this world, he might even make that visit personally. Just remember, changing your name can only fool him for so long. But let's step away from the past and come back to the present, shall we? Where a search for creatures of the deep turns into a study of ones from the stars. But in our second Grant Hinton story, sometimes a hunger for science can be overwhelmed by, well, just hunger. Without further ado, I present to you Amphipoda. The world was small, like a tiny blue and white marble whirling on a sheet of black glass. Peppering it like glitter were thousands of stars. Lunar module pilot Marcus Winthrop witnessed it all from the exterior of the International Space Station. Sweat beaded his brow, even though the Novak liquid cooling suit kept him at an even temperature. The reason he was outside was a fist-sized hole in one of the panels of the solar array. What had made it, he didn't have a clue. Docking module pilot Brian Rockstar Evans came through the comlink with a metallic buzz. You think Miranda will let me take her out tonight? She's a cardboard cutter, Rockstar, Marcus said, probing the hole. I don't think she'll care. The impact had damaged the panel beyond repair. Sparks burst out from the speckled glass, the metal ribbons within, changing color with the slightest move of his head. He used pliers to extract the offending object, a frost-encrusted ball. Been up here way too long, buddy. You know that, right? He said with a grunt. Ouch, man. Just ouch. Just saying. Silence fell as Marcus moved the pliers around. The object was spherical, but slippery as hell. Come on, he said through gritted teeth. The pliers spread out. He pressed the button again, and the claws slowly retracted around the object. This time they stayed. Hey, Mark. NAI is picking a quick-moving shower of debris. I want to wrap this up and come inside. The system is readying to boost out of the impact zone. Marcus pulled the ball out of the array, the pliers shaking in his hand. What the hell? What is it? Can't see. Bring it up on camera. Rockstar watched the monitor as a white-shaped orb, roughly the size of a tennis ball, came into view in front of the backdrop of Earth. It's not a rock. Maybe just
space hail? But hold on, what's this?
Marcus twirled it slowly around. The sides were encrusted in ice except for a ridge that looked like Pac-Man's smile. He wiped it on the first covering of the translucent section. Is that...
Ow!
Something slammed in Marcus' shoulder. He lost his handhold and fell away from the ship, just as the International Space Station's NAI went berserk. The IAS shuddered as the boosters engaged. Blue fire propelled the massive station forward. Marcus somersaulted away into the void of space until the end of the safety rope snapped tautly. Rockstar screamed through the comlink.
Oh no! They're already here! Incoming meteor shower!
The meteors peppered the ISS. Scores of them pierced the hull at multiple points, sending showers of sparks out into space.
Rockstar!
The sweat on Marcus's brow was now tinged with fear.
Rockstar!
The calm whirled with static and then...
Ryan, come in!
The International Space Station exploded and joined the shower of meteors falling to Earth. 374 nautical miles off the coast of Western Australia, Dr. Jessica Moriarty gently moved the joystick to an aged subterranean drone. Deep below, in a sea of calm, Atlas's mechanical arms moved in response. Tensions were running high.
Careful,
warned Captain Omar as he stroked the fur of the dog at his side.
Going to bottom out,
snarked Lachlan, the ship's technician. They watched the monitor as a mechanical arm holding a glass capsule edged nearer the amphiboda.
I got this, just relax.
Moriarty blew a strand of hair out of her face.
Just let me...
The small crustaceans bobbed an inch off the surface of the ocean floor. The capsule wobbled slightly. The video link shook as Atlas bottomed out and struck the rock bed below. The amphiboda skittered away.
Damn!
Moriarty slammed her head down on the console.
Told you,
Lachlan said, pushing away from the chair, as Moriarty stood up.
Don't you dare start with me.
Lachlan hid his snigger as Moriarty stormed outside. Captain Omar gave Lachlan a glare that told the young copperhead man that he was pushing it too far. He threw his hands in the air in defense.
Wipe that smile off your face, Locke.
Go get Mavis from the engine room and both of you get Atlas back in the dock.
Rusty, he said, turning to his dog.
Bed.
Good boy.
Omar knew she would fail. He hoped she was different, but for all her academic prowess, she lacked one thing from the beginning. He wasn't sure what it was, but he knew she didn't have it. Maybe it was why he'd taken her on board. She reminded him of a younger, less worn version of himself. Unpredictable, reckless, but extremely talented. He shook his head as he watched her fume at the night sky. He was deluding himself. He knew why he had taken her on board. Captain Omar closed the sliding door of the bridge and waited in the warm air for her to acknowledge him. The night was heavy with the mugginess of summer and the wind gave it no release. It was a still night, one without clouds. One where you didn't know where the ocean ended and the sky began. Omar saw her shoulders slowly relax and took a step towards her. A wise man once said, if you bend it, you mend it. She shot him a frustrated glance.
What the hell were you thinking?
Even numbnuts could see you were bottoming out.
At it.
She said it to the ocean, letting the non-existent wind take away the edges of disbelief. Omar patted her on the shoulder, then rested a hand on the ship's rail and looked up into the stars. Now, you didn't have it, or it would be in the capsule on its way to the surface. He looked at the billions of twinkling stars. One seemed to explode with brightness. It didn't matter if he spent 1,000 years in the ocean. It would never stop him from feeling insignificant. Moriarty had the good grace to blush. Omar saw it out of the corner of his eye, but kept his gaze to the heavens to alleviate her embarrassment.
He didn't want her to feel too bad, just enough that she didn't mess up again. A star blazed a trail across the sky. Persistence is a good thing, Moriarty. It's got you where you are now, but you can't just power through everything. You need to learn some patience, some grace, some finesse. It's not grace or finesse I need, Harry. The captain's eyes widened at the use of his first name. Truth be told, she was the only one he allowed to use it, although she didn't know that. Moriarty shook her head and sighed. Maybe I shouldn't be here. Don't get your panties in a wad. It doesn't suit you. You're part of my crew. That makes us family. But know this. I didn't pick you for your pretty face. I picked you for what's in your head. You're a tough one, like your dad, and a problem solver to boot. Your problem is, you can't solve your own problems. And what's that then? You worry too much about what everyone else thinks. Screw them. Get it good on your own. If we don't get results today, bah. We'll try again tomorrow. But, he paused, cocking his ear to one side, his eyes scanning the darkness beyond the large ship. Paused for so long, Moriarty nudged him. But what? Moriarty followed his gaze but saw nothing of interest. What? Oh, yeah, we do need results, or we'll all be hung out to dry. Moriarty looked at him as the words settled in. She knew the Grants were slowing up. This was the fourth expedition and still no results. If they had the crustacean, then maybe she would have something. Something was better at getting more grant money than nothing. A thought occurred to her. Why did you let me pilot Atlas when Lachlan's the controller? Did you set me up for a fall? She asked. The captain kept his gaze fixed on the ocean. A puzzled expression settled on his face. His eyes drew tight like they did when he was looking for dangers out at sea. Because everyone should learn to use Atlas, he said out of the corner of his mouth, his attention still on the ocean. And it would look better that your name is on the papers. Okay, next question. Why did you take me on board? Moriarty demanded. The captain turned to her, settled a hand on her shoulder, and sighed. Because I heard about a young lady that was getting straight A's at university. Her professors were astounded by her progress until some douchebag thought it would be a good idea to manhandle her. Moriarty heard the lie. She knew him better than that. Ever since she was a small child, she had been a part of the sea. Her father sailed with Omar when they were young. She, in turn, sailed with her father. She may have only seen the weather-beaten man before her once a year when he returned from his home in Cyprus, but she remembered him. You've been keeping tabs on me, haven't you? When did my dad ask you? 2 months before he died? A week? It wasn't like that. So it was because of my dad. No, it wasn't. I meant what I said. You showed promise. The only promise you made was one to a dying man. Moriarty dashed away a stray tear. You didn't need me on board. You took me out of pity. The captain turned back to the open sea, his attention once again strained against the lapping water. You know, I thought you were different. Shut up, will you? No, I'm not shut up. Shut up. Listen. Moriarty strained her hearing. The waves lapped against the hull with a steady tattoo. The boat creaked with the gentle movement of the waves. And at the edges of that peacefulness was something completely out of place. Something whizzed past the boat and thundered into the sea. Omar turned. Another whizzed past. A splash of water from its impact sprayed over the boat. Is that hail? There aren't any clouds in the sky. Moriarty said, frowning skyward. The sound grew nearer. It sounds like whales feeding, but it's not daylight. They're not this far south this time of the year, said Omar. All of a sudden, a single lump of hail the size of a tennis ball
smashed into the roof and fell to the floor. It was closely followed by another, and then another. Hail began to pelt the boat. Frozen rocks ricocheted off the metal, smashed glass, and penetrated plastic.
"Inside! Now!"
shouted Omar. The noise was deafening. Moriarty cowered under the captain's chair. Omar stood rigid by the control wall, his gaze swinging from damage to damage. Lachlan raced up the stairs, Mavis at his heels. He shot them both a worried look. Rusty barked from under a chair.
"What the hell's happening?"
And as fast as it came, the shower vanished. Glass peppered the cockpit like bioluminescent algae. The perpetrators littered the floor, each one a frost-covered sphere of white. Lachlan picked one up and rolled it in his hands. "That's some hailstones, Cap." He threw it to Omar. Something bugged the captain. Sure, it wasn't having a hailstorm at sea. That happens. But it didn't happen from a cloudless sky. As he rotated the ball in his hand, he nearly dropped it. "Jessica?" Moriarty's hyper-awareness kicked into overdrive. He never called her by her first name out of respect, even if he had a weird way of showing it. To hear her first name meant something bad. Moriarty came to his side and peeled the hail from his fingers. Lachlan picked up a few more and passed one to Mavis. The brown-haired woman lifted it into the light of the ship. Something pink and vaguely shrimp-like glowed within. "What are they?" she asked, looking at Moriarty.
I don't know.
"They look like amphipods, but the thorax and abdomen are different." Moriarty moved through the ship. The crew followed her through the metal corridors. She opened her study door and rooted around for a few seconds until she found a leather-bound book. She threw it on her desk. "Look, here." Moriarty scrambled through the pages. The legs are typically laterally compressed, but these aren't. And this one has 16 sets of uniramus appendages opposed to 8. She rapped at the book. The crew crowded around her shoulders. The mouthpiece would normally carry 6, which are used as accessory mouthparts. The next 4 pairs are directed forward, and the last 3 pairs are directed backward, but this one, she held it over her lamp. This one has them all facing forwards. "It's like a space shrimp," exclaimed Lachlan. As Moriarty rotated the sphere, Mavis went rigid. A short, sharp bark of pain escaped her lips. She dropped the hail and fell to the floor, withering. All thought of the strange creature lost. Lachlan pulled her onto his lap. Concerned lines etched into his normally mischievous face as he parted her waves of brown hair.
"Mavis," Lachlan said, slapping her cheek slightly.
"Quickly, Locke, take her to the med room. Moriarty, go to prep the EM unit," Omar said, moving quickly toward the door. Moments later, Mavis lay on the ship examination table. Her skin was a pale shade of yellow. Lachlan paced, chewing his already non-existent fingernails, while Moriarty examined a slide under the microscope.
"What is it?" Omar asked.
Moriarty stood up, grimaced, and then moved aside to allow the captain to look. Omar moved into the vacated eyepiece of the microscope and examined the blood. Moriarty flipped through more pages.
"I don't understand. The cells are morphing. It's changing out the red and white blood cells."
Omar stalked back over to Mavis. Lachlan moaned, his head down in the crook of his arm. Omar pried the frosted sphere from his hand.
"What are you doing?"
Moriarty asked, following him out to the moon pool. A large pool of water at the center of the room ringed around with diving equipment. A submersible vehicle sat off to one side. Moriarty grimaced at the long scratch and dent on the undercarriage.
"Whatever this is," he said, dropping it into a fish tank, "has the answers."
The sphere dissolved slowly. The creature within awoke with the water, poked its head through the crack and pushed, the crack widening rapidly until it broke through. The fish in the tank swam to one corner
as if knowing that a predator now stalked the water. You gotta be kidding. Omar stepped back as the creature attacked the other fish. The multitude of legs extended out like snakes and wrapped around its prey. The fish fought to be free. The creature pulled. The fish thrashed. As they drew near, the body split and opened like a Venus flytrap. Rows of razor teeth clamped on the fish. Soon, they stopped trying to look through the blood. I've never seen anything like it before. Not even a shark is that ferocious. Moriarty backed away. Rusty barked at the glass, and the creature turned in their direction. It can see us. Omar approached the glass tank and tapped a finger on the side. The shrimp-like creature rammed the glass again and again. Omar stepped back as a crack appeared. It's gonna break it. With a loud crack, the glass split asunder. The water pooled at their feet and slipped into the moon pool. The creature thrashed on the floor. Slowly, its spasms decreased. The pink skin turned blue and then to black. The thrashing stopped. The creature died. So, oxygen kills it? Asked Omar. That or something in the air. At least we know they can be killed. Suddenly, the moon pool started to boil with bubbles. What the hell? Omar crept toward the edge and looked down into the bubbles of water. Another space shrimp burst up. Its elongated legs came inches from his face. He scurried back. The shrimp fell to the floor and withered in pain. Rusty barked and gnashed his teeth. The creature thrashed and then went still. The pool simmered down. The creatures underneath the water whipped around, but none broke the surface. Down, boy, Omar commanded. The red-haired dog whimpered and crept close, intent on sniffing the strange thing before it. As he drew near, the thrashing ceased. Rusty, growled Omar. Away! Rusty nudged it with his nose and sniffed. Finding the creature dead, he then turned away. Just before he turned completely, the creature came back to life. The body split apart and the hideous legs scurried together. Moriarty stood frozen in shock as the legs clamped around the dog's face and pulled it off its feet. The moon pool burst to life again. More space shrimp jumped out as if a call to arms had gone up. Each extended their legs like an interlocking chain. Rusty slipped across the watery surface toward the pool. Rusty! No! Omar made a dive for him, but it was too late. The dog disappeared over the edge and into the moon pool. The water bubbled furiously and clouded red.
Damn it!
Captain, get back,
Moriarty warned. The lights flickered and died as the engines groaned to a halt. Plunged into eerie silence, the two watched the edge of the water. The bubbles ceased. The emergency lights clicked on, illuminating them in an anxious red light. Omar got to his feet and wiped himself down. Moriarty didn't need the lights to see the cast on his shoulders.
Damn, Doc. Why didn't it listen?
Now the engines have gone, and that's all we need, said Omar.
Go grab a light, will you?
He turned, not waiting for Moriarty to catch up. He opened a hatch to the corridor leading to the engine room and disappeared. Moriarty saw his once proud shoulders slag with grief. He knew Rusty had been a part of the crew longer than anyone on the ship. He might not have shown it, but the death of his dog had earned those creatures a one-way ticket to hell. And if Moriarty was right, Omar would be the one to lead them there himself. They sat in the rec room. Lachlan hunched in a chair asleep. Exhaustion had finally taken him. Moriarty had sedated Mavis. With her condition stable, she'd be fine until further medical help could be found. Omar had radioed a distress call while the ship drifted. They'd found the reason the engines had died, and it wasn't good. Omar sloshed a glass of brandy around, his attention somewhere else. Moriarty hunched over her books. She hoped that an answer would be somewhere in one of the volumes. But all that was forthcoming was a headache. She slammed the book closed. It's nothing like these things here on Earth. Unless somehow... What? They came from space. Omar barked with laughter. Lachlan woke, groaned, and covered his ears. I have a theory. She let his comments pass without reaction. Maybe an amphipoda egg stem migrated to the surface. A storm came along and whipped them into the stratosphere. They condensed with the clouds and fell as rain, somehow evolving along the way. I think space shrimps are more believable. Omar topped up his glass and then collapsed into a chair. As long as those things are in the water and we're here, they can't hurt us. He poured a small amount on the floor and raised his glass. He grimaced as the brandy burned his throat. I know you're grieving, Harry, she said, coming to his side. He looked her defiantly in the eyes, and then the look slipped, as if his resolve died. But you've got to pull yourself together, man. You're the captain. It's not worth getting drunk over. We need you. Omar closed his eyes and nodded. You're right, he said, sliding the glass away. He kicked off his seat from the counter and stood. Listen up, he said, clearing his throat. Okay, Locke. They turned to where the young man was asleep, but found only an empty chair. Then the sound of a metal door banging reverberated through the ship. Oh, crap. We've got to stop him. They raced down the corridor to the med room. Behind the glass window, Mavis stood backed up against the wall, her hands wrapped around Lachlan's chest. Moriarty pushed the door open. Mavis hissed. He's ours now. She spoke with a thousand voices. Each one was as wet as the sea. It was as if her vocal cords had liquefied. Whoa, Mavis, calm down. Moriarty raised her hands. Mavis' skin was almost translucent. Beneath, in an intricate detail, were the fibers of her muscle and the hollow tubes of her veins. Her blood was completely see-through. Forget that. She's gone. Omar opened up a box in the wall, snatched out the flare gun, and pointed it at Mavis. Lachlan's eyes rolled in his head. You kill us, he dies too. Moriarty bridged between them. Wait, look. They hadn't noticed the steadily growing pool around Lachlan's feet, or the numerous tentacle-like appendages that burrowed into his sides. She was feeding on him. He's already dead. Omar shot. The flare whirled toward Mavis. She threw the body of Lachlan at the flaming shot and charged them. Moriarty was bowled over by the impact. Her head came away slick with blood from the metal walls. When she looked up, Mavis stood over her. A cut ran from her pubis to her chest. The tentacles that they had seen slipped back into the void. She cocked her head, white eyes drawn and pale, and regarded Moriarty. Mavis dived forward, grabbed her foot, and ran down the corridor, dragging her along. Moriarty knew where she was taking her. Soon the moon pool came into view. She skidded to a halt. The water bubbled again with the space shrimp, each one eager to taste flesh again. Mavis shook like a rattlesnake. Her appendage snaked out to the water as if tasting the air. When she turned back, Moriarty saw the monster she'd become. Another gunshot rang out and Mavis flew away, the red flare buried deep in her head. Moriarty cowered as the flare exploded. Wet pieces of body slapped around them, along with chunks of skinless fat. You all right? Omar said, helping Moriarty to her feet. She wiped her hand against her head, the blood still tinged her fingers. I think so. The ship suddenly shuddered. A loud groan ripped through the vessel like the metal protesting to an extreme amount of force. A siren filled the air. Red strobe lights began to blink on and off in unison with the alarm. The ship was sinking. It started to list. The groaning continued like a discombobulated whale song. Omar knew instantly what this meant, and when he turned to face Moriarty, he knew she understood too. What's the plan, Moriarty? She looked at him incredulously. I don't know. You're the captain. They exchanged puzzled looks. Moriarty spoke out. Well, the engines are screwed. The ship's sinking.
and we've just been added to the menu. The ship might be screwed, but we can use it to blow those bastards out of the water, said Omar, motioning toward Atlas. We've just got to get across to Atlas. But it's a one-man vessel. Omar grinned at her. She saw the play of wickedness dance in his eyes. No, she said. I won't let you. The water crept over the edge, and the ship toppled over a little more. Moriarty placed a foot on the side rails. Omar pulled himself up to match. You don't have a choice. We get to Atlas. You get on board and dive free. I'll open the fuel lines and dose this old bitch with so much gas that you'll see the explosion from space. The captain pushed the flare gun into her hands. I promised your father I'd look out for you. I'll let the old bastard know that you made him proud. Tears washed Moriarty's cheeks. If truth be told, she missed her father terribly. But he had driven it into her to be strong, to hide her feelings because they made you weak. She wished he hadn't. She wished she'd told him she loved him. But she didn't. Omar reached over to a storage box and pried the lid open. Inside, he found a can of aerosol cleaner and a lighter. He tested it with a few sharp bursts of flame. The space shrimp that had drawn near darted away. With his make-do flamethrower, Omar jumped down into the rising water. He turned, grabbed Moriarty, and swung her onto his back. With each step, he shot out a clean jet of flame. The creature whirled around the edges. None dared the fire. Open the hatch! Moriarty leaned over. Omar cried out in pain. Through gritted teeth, he stepped forward. The water turned red as flesh was stripped from the bone. The flames sprang out, and the water fizzled. Get it! I can't leave you! I'm already dead. Now go! He slammed Atlas's lid closed as Moriarty's worried eyes watched him leave. Moriarty clicked the controls, and Atlas came to light. The water rose. Hundreds, if not thousands, of the space shrimp crowded around her, legs pecking at the glass of her hull. She dived into the inky blackness of the Indian Sea. Like a billowing mass, the creatures followed her down. She couldn't see behind her, but they rammed and crashed into the side of the glass, shaking Atlas until suddenly they stopped. She sped away in a whirl of spinning propellers. 20 feet clear of the sinking ship, the lights of the sub resurfaced. Moriarty's breath fogged up the glass. She didn't open the hatch in fear of creatures returning. In the failing lights of the moon and the headlights of the sub, she watched as Omar stood on the side of the ship. In his hand was a lever. It belonged to the fuel dump valve. But that wasn't all that had changed. His torso was ripped asunder. The tentacled appendages of shrimp creatures creased the air through the wound. Omar was dead. Damn it. She kicked out in the cramped confinement. Tears clouded her vision. Omar knew what she had only just realized. He spread his hands wide, his chest cavity rippling to the wind. The space shrimp jumped out of the sea and attached to his tentacles. They billowed and warped, each one adding to the mass that was Omar. Moriarty's knees shook. The hatch popped and hissed. The wind whipped around her face. All thoughts of survival were gone. She was in the middle of the Indian Ocean, scared and alone. By the time a rescue team made it to the coordinates, the ship would be long gone, along with her, and any trace of the Nautilus. She cocked the flare gun and squinted through the rain. Omar was gone, hidden in the mass of tentacles and crustaceans. The colossal creature roared. How's this for finesse? Moriarty fired. She watched the flare arc and then dip over the creature and waited for the explosion. But nothing happened. To her dismay, the creature kept growing. Rain pelted Moriarty's face. Suddenly, the boat lit up. The explosion rocked the sub, sending her back into the cockpit. Moriarty gripped the controls as a huge wave washed over her. Pieces of the boat rained down around her. As she gazed up, one of the creatures landed in the cockpit. She screamed and was about to plummet it when she stopped. The thing was dead, its pinkish body slowly turning gray. As the last of the debris fell, the night calmed. It was quiet. Moriarty breathed a sigh of relief. 2 days later, Moriarty sat in a straight-back chair fidgeting. The gentleman across the large desk held the capsule up to the light. She glanced out the 71st floor window. That's quite some tale. If I was an ordinary man, I would, at this point, scoff, call you a lunatic and have you thrown out. But I'm not ordinary, and you're not a lunatic. So you do believe me? Moriarty had her reservations about this man, and the company he kept since her abduction 2 days ago. Of course I believe you. Why wouldn't I? Moriarty denied him an answer and instead turned her attention to the capsule and the alien creature. The man watched her expression change from mild displeasure to rage. Why the hell do you want that thing, anyway? Because it can answer that ultimate question. Are we alone? And the truth is, no, we are not. The man sat back. You look troubled. That thing, she spat, killed my friends. I should have let them all sink to the bottom of the ocean. But you didn't. Why? Moriarty deflated. It was true. She had saved it. The scientist in her wouldn't let the opportunity pass her by, despite the things killing those closest to her. I'll tell you why. Because you're a scientist. You should be proud. You might live to see the birth of something great. Are you letting me go or recruiting me? Moriarty asked, her eyebrows raised. Recruiting, of course. I'm sure you wouldn't like the other option. He glanced at the two men that brought her before him. They came over and untied her hand. Doesn't look like I got much of a choice, she said, rubbing at her wrists. The man nodded his head, the sunlight gleaming off his shiny bald head. See, you are a smart girl. Now, let's make history. I hope you enjoyed Amphipoda, as written by author Grant Hinton and performed by yours truly. I've heard of You Are What You Eat, but this may be the first time I've heard of You Are What Eats You. Lobsterfest seems like it might be a little interesting this year. If you enjoyed the tales you've heard tonight, I'd like to remind you one last time that tonight's featured author can be found by visiting our website. Just visit simplyscarypodcast.com/Hinton. That's simplyscarypodcast.com/Hinton, spelled H-I-N-T-O-N. Once again, you'll be redirected to his profile on our horror fiction website, creepypastastories.com, where you'll find more info about Grant, including links to contact him and to find him on Amazon, his website, and many of the popular social media sites. If you happen to stop by Amazon, be sure to check out Grant's 2020 book, Scary Tales, a collection of reimagined dark fairy tales. Scary Tales features a diverse tapestry of stories that show that fairy tales don't always have a happy ending, with 8 classic fairy tales transformed into the stuff of nightmares. If you're a fan of Black Mirror, Twilight Zone, the Dark Fairy Tale series, and the original Brothers Grimm material, then I know you'll love this collection of tales that distort all of your nostalgic childhood favorites. I know I did. As a reminder, if you decide to give any of this talented author's books or stories a read, please consider leaving him a quality review and a kind word, or a thoughtful public comment and an upvote. And be sure to let him know you heard about him on this program and that Otis sent you. It means more to me than you can imagine, and I'm sure Grant would much appreciate it as well. Thanks again for your support of this show and of tonight's featured author.
Now, before we go, I'd also like to take a moment to thank you personally for joining me on this episode of Scary Stories Told in the Dark. If you enjoyed what you've heard on today's program, please take a moment to stop by our iTunes page or wherever else you listen to your favorite podcasts and leave us a 5-star review and a kind word. It makes a huge difference and would mean a lot to us. If you'd like to hear a premium extended edition of tonight's and all of our other episodes featuring twice the terror, visit simplyscarypodcast.com today and click the patrons link in the menu at the top of the screen. You'll find yourself at chillingtalesfordarknights.com, where you can purchase season passes for this podcast and our other quality storytelling programs, or become a patron for as little as $5 per month and get access to our entire audio archive dating back to 2012, all of it ad-free. If you happen to use Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, or YouTube, you can follow and subscribe to Chilling Tales for Dark Nights there, where you'll get all of our latest updates and new releases and have the chance to interact with us each and every week. You can subscribe to me on YouTube as well at the Otis Chiry channel, where you'll find releases of my series, Horror Story Time, dating back to 2014. And you can find me on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram, too. Just search for Otis Chiry. Until next week, stay spooky and get some sleep. If you can.
Thanks for listening. You've been listening to Scary Stories Told in the Dark, a production of Chilling Entertainment and the creative team at Chilling Tales for Dark Nights, and a proud member of the Simply Scary Podcasts Network. Visit simplyscarypodcast.com today to learn more about our network and our other amazing storytelling programs. Tonight's program was hosted, and its featured stories, performed by yours truly, Otis Chiry. Selected stories have been adapted with the kind permission of their respective authors. Original music provided by Luke Hodgkinson and Jesse Cornett. Sound design and final mixing and mastering provided by executive producer and director Craig Groschen. Program's artwork and logo by David Romero. If you're looking for some fresh tales on a daily basis while waiting for the next podcast, check out my YouTube channel, the Otis Chiry channel, and my extensive collection of narrated tales there. Simply search on YouTube by my name and you'll find me. And don't forget to subscribe and press the bell notification icon to get my latest releases. Got a scary tale of your own that you'd like performed? I take submissions. Email it to me today at otis@simplyscarypodcast.com to have your terrifying tome considered for production in a future episode of this show. That's otis@simplyscarypodcast.com. If you've enjoyed what you heard on tonight's program and are joining us on your favorite podcast app, subscribe to us to be sure you never miss an episode and leave a 5-star review and a comment. Your feedback means a lot to me. You can also follow Chilling Tales for Dark Nights and yours truly on Facebook to connect anytime and get the latest updates on this and other programs and my channel. If you're listening on the Chilling Tales for Dark Nights YouTube channel, do us a favor and hit the subscribe button and the bell notification icon for CTFDN as well to get more spooky tales from me and the crew and another episode of this program each and every Wednesday. And don't forget to hit that thumbs up button to tell us how we're doing and leave a kind word or a request. And don't forget to visit us at chillingtalesfordarknights.com and consider supporting the team by becoming a patron. In addition to helping us out, you'll get exclusive access to our audio archive and ad-free downloads of all your favorite stories, including those you've heard on this program. As for me, I'll be back next Wednesday with more terrifying tales to keep you up all night. But that's all right. Who needs sleep anyway?
Angie has made it easier than ever to connect with skilled professionals to get all your jobs projects done well. If you own a home, you know how much work it can take, whether it's everyday maintenance and repairs or making dream projects a reality. It can be hard just to know where to start, but now all you need to do is Angie that and find a skilled local pro who will deliver the quality and expertise you need. Angie has over 20 years of home service experience, and they've combined it with new tools to simplify the whole process. Bring them your project online or with the Angie app, answer a few questions, and Angie can handle the rest from start to finish, or help you compare quotes from multiple pros and connect instantly, which means you can take care of just about any home project in just a few taps. Because when it comes to getting the most out of your home, you can do this when you Angie that. Download the free Angie mobile app today or visit Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I.com.